Hey again, everybody. John Porteous of the Lovells Township Historical Society here, along with Richard Perry, and you're listening to the Backcast Podcast. Our guest this week is Amy Trotter of MUCC. Amy, welcome aboard. How are you this afternoon?
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
It's great. It's great that you could join us. Amy is the CEO of the Michigan United Conservation Club. And this is an organization, Amy, if I'm not mistaken, that dates back to 1937?
Correct, exactly. 86 years ago yesterday.
That's awesome. Oh, well, we'll catch you right on then. Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Well, tell me, did you grow up in Michigan?
I did, born and raised, actually in Sheboygan, so tip of the mitt, and had a great time growing up with a bunch of hunters and anglers, and was really into science. I had the great opportunity to go over to University of Michigan's biological station, where they had a great program for kids, getting them outdoors and learning about science. And I think that's probably what, you know, got me into this natural resources arena. Although originally, after graduating from high school, I came to Michigan State University as a chemistry major. But, you know, you start working with acids and you get a little bit on your fingertips and they peel off, and then you decide maybe water and trees sounds a little bit safer. So that led me to a degree in environmental science from Michigan State about 20 years ago now.
Awesome. You kind of mentioned you grew up in the field and the stream?
You know, it's interesting because as much as I grew up around hunting and fishing, and I did enjoy the outdoors and, you know, making sure that we always had access because we have Mullet Lake and Burt Lake up there. So, you know, did a lot of swimming and things like that. But I never was really into hunting and fishing growing up. And in part, I think it's just because, you know, I wasn't necessarily invited by all the guys in the family. It was something that the guys went and did. And my mom and my grandma and me and my sister, you know, we didn't. You know, we did other things. And So I was one of those, I guess if you'd call it early adult onset hunter. So it really wasn't until I joined the staff here at MUCC that I actually got hunter safety certified. Now, I had always grown up, you know, going out with my friends to the ice chanty and things like that. So, you know, I've always, you know, caught bluegills and things like that. But, I can't say that I had a lot of experience even walking into this job. I knew about the rules and the regulations and the benefits of management of species, but I didn't have as much hands-on experience when I first started at MUCC, which now is more than 16 years ago.
And is it fair to say that you are immersed in that now?
Absolutely. So in my position, I have the great fortune to come into contact with every manner of hunting and fishing there is here in Michigan, and, you know, an endless supply of people that want to introduce me to whatever it is that they're passionate about. So I also married a hunter, an angler, and so he is someone who, you know, taken me to get my first deer, and which was, you know, now years ago. So I do enjoy deer hunting, but I would say my passion is probably duck hunting. And then I still really just enjoy, you know, dunking a worm and fishing for bluegills with my daughters and things like that. So we do a lot as a family. So, but then I try to take advantage of as many opportunities as I can. I just learned with an intensive lesson through Trappers College, a lot more about trapping. So I was able to trap and learn how to do that just this fall. And that's one thing that's kind of we're adding now as a new family activity this winter to come.
That ought to be pretty interesting.
Yes.
I'll circle back with you offline because I kind of want to hear how that goes. That's exciting. Well, how did you land at MUCC?
Yeah, well, again, I had a degree in environmental science. And while I was still in college, I was actually working for the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. So they're the group that works a lot with farmers and landowners about resource concerns on their property. So not from a regulatory perspective, but really from a, you know, how can we provide technical and financial assistance to address these issues, and whether it's erosion or, you know, water quality issues or, you know, timber stand improvements. I did that for 2 summers in the field, you know, working with farmers and landowners. I had a great farmer's tan going and thought I was going to make a career of that, actually. I really did enjoy it. But when you graduate from college, they want to place you in the agency for the first time, at least back then, they didn't give you the choice of which field office to go to. And, you know, I had a lease here down in East Lansing at Michigan State, and my family was in Sheboygan, and they gave me a field office that wasn't near anything that I knew here in Michigan. And I said, well, maybe I just want to look around a little bit here and try to figure out if there's something that's going to work better for me just at that stage in my life. And I actually fell into a job with Public Sector Consultants. And that's a public policy research firm here in Lansing, and I didn't even know what those words really meant when I started working for them. But I had the great fortune of jumping in at a time when a lot of the work they were doing, because they get hired by their clients to do in-depth research on what problems are we trying to solve in Michigan and what are some public policy solutions that we could apply to that. And Governor Granholm at the time was forming a bunch of blue ribbon panels and commissions and bringing people together around different issues. And probably within my first week of working at Public Sector Consultants, I actually helped write the proposal that was the foundation for the creation of the Land Use Leadership Council back in 2003. That was co-chaired by Governor Milliken and Attorney General Frank Kelly. So I had, you know, the awesome opportunity first out of college to work with two wonderful gentlemen and, you know, just sort of my idols in the civil discourse of government in terms of leadership, to work on some tough issues around urban sprawl and, you know, farmland preservation and all these different public policy initiatives. And so I worked for Public Sector Consultants for about 4.5 years. But what I found myself learning is that in this consulting business, you're left with doing all this research and putting together all these ideas, but then you hand that report back to your client. And what you don't get to do when you're a consultant is then go advocate for
right.
it. And that's what I found myself wanting to do. And I actually helped manage the softball team, and a lot of my friends worked for Michigan United Conservation Clubs here. And so one thing led to another, and one of the staff people here at MUCC was leaving to go to law school. And so I got recruited to fill his position. And so I wanted to try my hand in advocacy. So I've been here ever since 2007.
That's pretty exciting.
Oh, so you came up through the ranks at MUSCC. That's good. You didn't get hired in at the top level.
No, yeah. I started off as a resource policy specialist, and I did that for a lot of years. Then I became a policy manager and then eventually deputy director and then was named executive director, and they just turned my title into CEO just this year. So, but I took over MUCC when the previous executive director, Dan Eichinger, went off to go become the DNR director at the very beginning of the Whitmer administration.
Nice. What a great organization in that. It's you've got your fingers all over the place in terms of, I guess, just as a function of all the wonderful opportunities for outdoor recreation that Michigan presents people.
So how many folks
what was that?
I was just wondering, you got a pretty broad, to add to what John said, a broad scope of activities you do and events, and you know, like he said, you're all over the place. How many folks do you guys have on staff?
Well, actually, we run a statewide organization with a pretty skeleton crew. We have only 10 full-time staff people, and then we always have you know, a couple interns. We have an AmeriCorps member, and then we have seasonal staff for our summer youth camp. But, yeah, we run an organization that, you know, I've been told probably punches beyond our weight because of how few people we have, you know, here running the organization. But we represent more than 40,000 members across the state and 200 affiliate clubs. And we cover all the fur, fin, and feather groups that you could name, in addition to those people that, you know, are hunters, trappers, anglers, and just come to us through the cause of conservation.
So who would be your affiliate groups? I got to plead ignorance. I don't know.
Yeah, so we have a lot of the local rod and gun clubs across the state. So, for example, Montmorency County Conservation Club, Alpena Sportsman's Club, you know, Oakland County Sportsman's Club. So those kinds of groups all across the state, but then we also have statewide organizations. So the Michigan Bear Hunters Association, the Michigan Hunting Dog Federation, and then we have groups like, you know, national groups that have maybe a statewide council or board. So, for example, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, National Wild Turkey Federation. So all of those groups are members of MUCC. And it's something that they're deciding to do. It's not that like Pheasants Forever, where we have the chapter model, where all of our groups are sort of part of MUCC. They are their own separate 501c whatever organizations, and they have their own boards and their own budgets, and then they join and pay dues to be a member of MUCC because they feel that's the best way of really getting done what their members want in terms of advocacy and conservation efforts.
Well, they can just kind of focus their lobbying and so forth.
Well, you can kind of get parallel scale that way. So if the Acme Fishing Club has the same aspirations as the Widget Fishing Club, and they're both members, you could advocate for both their behalves, right?
Exactly. So we do have a rather complicated process. It's not as complicated as it sounds, but any member of our organization can engage in our policy setting process because it's not me and my staff sitting here in Lansing that decide the positions that we take on any given issue that I might be talking about. It is our members. So our members come up with these ideas in the form of a resolution. They then take that to our annual convention, and if it's adopted by a two-thirds majority of our voting delegates, and the voting delegates are representatives of our affiliate clubs as well as, you know, regional representatives representing the unaffiliated members as well, if it passes by a two-thirds majority at our annual convention, then it gives me my marching orders here in Lansing to go and implement. So it's really a grassroots organization.
That's awesome in that there's not an arbitrary setting of a direction then. It's
so your convention, what that's coming up next month?
March?
Our convention is actually coming up in March. So we have quarterly policy meetings where people bring forward these ideas in the form of a resolution. And our policy meetings are kind of the first vetting of those ideas, where they might do some amendments. They help, you know, seek some clarification about what the intent is. Sometimes they have to go back to the drawing board, but once they pass that policy board level, and that meeting is coming up in December, then they go on to our annual convention, which is in March.
And Amy, to clarify, is this a documented submission at this point, or are these an opportunity to, if you will, throw a couple ideas against the wall and see if they stick?
It does have to be formed in the form of a resolution. So they do have to write it down. They have to have their whereases to support, you know, ultimately what they're asking MUCC to work on. And then once it, you know, is on its way to convention, then our staff pulls together information. We get a position, if you will, from the DNR, if they have one on that issue, to help add to the debate at our convention. So we do a little bit of work to, you know, pull together resources, information, get the department's take, and all of that then is made available to our voting delegates before they vote on these issues at convention.
That's pretty cool. When you go through with this, I guess downstream then, no pun intended, are you then advocating for your chosen policies with groups like the NRC or the DNR or the legislators?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. So I'm a registered lobbyist, and I have two more on our staff, and we also work with a multi-client lobbying firm here in Lansing. So we work at whatever level is appropriate for the policy that has been put forward. So if it is within the NRC's realm and their authority, then we're going to take those issues to them. And we actually, after our convention, will come to an NRC meeting and present the entire slate of resolutions that pass so that the NRC kind of knows what our working agenda is going forward, and they can hear a little bit more and have the opportunity to kind of ask questions as to why and what was involved in the discussion. So we do the same thing every year, or every legislative session. We try to do a opening presentation to both the House and the Senate Natural Resources Committees. So we try to, you know, make sure that legislators are aware of who we are and who we represent, how we come to these kinds of policy positions, and then also sort of what our legislative agenda might be for that year. And some of these things take multiple years, of course, to get through. It's never just a one-year time frame. So I actually have this book of, you know, 86 years of past policy that I have to go on. So you can imagine that everything under the sun has probably been talked about at one point in time in our history if it relates to conservation.
Yeah, or two or three times.
Yes.
Right. So perhaps I'm not sure how this percolated up into your organization, but in the show's not terribly political this way, but we're going to talk about it as a function of just documenting the history of the area. There's been a lot of emotion around the proposed Camp Grayling expansion. And for some of our listeners, this is a topic we haven't covered for a couple of months. Perhaps you could spend a moment and kind of maybe refresh the last 3 or 4 months and what maybe the next 3 or 4 months look like.
Yeah, so, you know, when the issue of the expansion of Camp Grayling came up, now it's been a couple of years ago when the first proposal came forward, we were actually able to look back in our past policies and see that as far back as 1989, we have been opposed to the expansion of Camp Grayling unless, you know, there was some, I guess, you know, national crisis where it was needed. But, you know, seeing that we haven't, you know, reached that point, we were able to confidently say that our members did not support the expansion and particularly the doubling of Camp Grayling on public lands. So we came out pretty hard against that initiative. Of course, a lot of things happened in that time and over that course of discussion. And ultimately, the DNR denied that request for the expansion. But what they did instead is, kind of scale down the amount of acres they would even consider the guard to be able to use. And then they said that the Camp Grayling people would have to apply for a special land use permit in order to potentially use some or any of those acres. And to my knowledge, ever since that new memorandum of agreement came out back in May, we have not seen that public request for special land use permit come out from the National Guard. So the DNR said, here's the acreage where we would even consider a land use permit. And at least as last I heard, we have not heard back from the National Guard on what or when or how much or what they'd be doing on that expansion of acres. So I think, if and when that application does arise, we will engage in that process, make sure that it is transparent and people can understand and know what is happening and when to expect whatever that activity might be.
Well, the only question there that's maybe it's a procedural thing that I should know, but how are these special use permits adjudicated, and what visibility do we have during the process?
The memorandum of understanding between the National Guard and the DNR outlines things that are already outside the bounds of something that the DNR would consider. So some of our initial concerns, of course, is whether or not they'd be operating in inland lake or trout stream. And the MOU already says that no training would be permitted to occur within 3,000 feet of one of those water bodies. They're not going to be permitted to use tanks or erect fencing or have any kind of live fire in these expanded areas, outside of the existing footprint of Camp Grayling. So the memorandum of understanding outlines some of those already, but I've asked the department to be transparent that when they do get an application from the National Guard, that they would inform the public about that request before it is decided by the DNR. But it is within the DNR director's control to approve that special land use permit.
So visibility is desirable, but not mandatory.
That's my understanding. It is an expectation I have of the department in terms of transparency, but it is ultimately at the discretion of the DNR director.
Okay.
I'd like to go to
is there such a thing as a proactive Freedom of Information request? Or?
I don't know about that.
I ask that out of complete ignorance and naivete. So, okay, well, so it goes. Thank you for that update. And but there's a lot more. There's I don't even know where it was. Let's start with. It's a couple of years old, but I think I've read it a couple of times, and I really like the areas you've touched on. So, and I'm referring to the Changing Seasons publication. Did you guys publish that or sponsor it or collaborate? What's the provenance on that?
Yeah, so this was actually a grant-funded initiative between MUCC and the National Wildlife Federation to really try to frame what climate change is doing to the average hunter and angler. So we took the perspectives of, hunters and anglers, representatives of organizations, hunting, fishing, trapping, conservation organizations, and we tried to distill it down to what are they seeing on the ground in terms of changes. So we were very conscious not to blame or say why it's happening or to try to change anyone's perspectives, but really just to observe that there are things happening on the ground that are different from how they used to be. And one of the things, the solutions, we want to be solution-oriented, is really that a lot of the things we advocate for, which is good active habitat management, you know, funding for critical things like wetlands, things like dam removals, you know, all of these things that we're already talking about as a conservation community are actually solutions not only to addressing whatever narrow species issue that we're talking about, but also in the bigger picture, they're a way to make fish and wildlife the most healthy they can be to mitigate the impacts of climate change. So whether it's, you know, addressing temperature issues or invasive species or wildlife disease, habitat and management are generally one of the solutions that is going to help in those scenarios. So whatever comes their way, we want fish and wildlife to be at their peak and be able to mitigate and be resilient in the face of climate change. So this document that we put together is really about recommendations for policy that, again, we've been talking about for decades, but we tried to put it in the lens of climate change because that is what the governor's administration has been talking about. That is what the legislature is working on. And so if we didn't talk about the issues that we care so much about in their terms, we weren't going to, you know, be able to get our foot in the door in some of those conversations. And the other thing we really tried to frame in here is that hunters and anglers do need to be part of those renewable energy conversations in particular, because siting matters. And the siting of these facilities, I mean, they are large scale energy production facilities, regardless of whether they're renewable or not. And where we put them matters. And we don't want to see valuable public land and land that is, you know, best utilized for fish and wildlife, you know, turned over to these large-scale renewable energy facilities. So we want to make sure that that is a part of the conversation here in Lansing. So that was our intent with this document and with this initiative. And we have a video, and there's, you know, all kinds of great, you know, social media graphics that we've used over the course of time. We've given a presentation to the legislature, to the Sportsman's Caucus, and to the DNR to make sure that they understand what we're talking about when we talk about climate change. Our solutions to it are really those things that, again, are habitat-focused and on the ground.
Well, and for people that may, I don't know, balk at climate change as a good enough reason, we're talking about, what, $11.2 billion a year generated by hunters and fishers and associated sales?
Absolutely. Our economic impact is big business in Michigan when it comes to hunting and fishing. So anything that can be done to make it healthy and improve that is going to be good for the bottom line of the state.
Yep. Well, and I just want to underscore that, because often things of substance like this get poo-pooed because, oh, well, it's just, you know, that's a green concern or something like that. This is hard money that is, you know, impactful on many, many levels, especially in the small rural communities where you know, that's that's a deal. But well, enough of that. Anywho, you've got a long, long history of significant contributions, you know, in this space. Please feel free to touch on a few so that our listeners can be further illuminated.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, two things I point to preceded me, of course. You know, that we are, sometimes people know that we were involved. Sometimes people only know you know, the outputs of these decisions that were made back in the 1970s. But two of the big things that MUCC led the charge on here in Lansing and across the state is the development of the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund and also the bottle deposit law. So those were both things that were signed back in the 70s that now have contributed so much and to really make Michigan a leader in conservation. So the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund, by way of background, was born out of a disagreement over the development of oil and gas on public lands, which continues to be, you know, a debate today still. But what we got out of that hot debate was an opportunity to capture royalties on those, you know, non-renewable resources getting pumped out and put that into the Natural Resources Trust Fund to permanently purchase lands across the state of Michigan for outdoor recreation and habitat, and also to develop recreational facilities. So since that time, the Natural Resources Trust Fund has contributed more than $1 billion to those endeavors here in our state. Born out of a horrible controversy where there was lawsuits and everything else, and you know, what we got out of that has made us the leader in land conservation and you know, having such an opportunity and a network of outdoor recreation opportunities across our state in terms of trails, in terms of our state game areas and boating access sites. All of those things, you know, have come from, or at least in part, have funding through the Michigan Natural Resources Trust Fund. So that was a huge initiative, and it continues today. But that was something that MUCC, you know, was really a leader in creating back in the 70s.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then the other one, the bottle deposit law, you know, everybody knows what the 10 cents means on a can here in Michigan for pop or beer or whatever. But again, that was an issue where we actually couldn't take it through the legislature. The politics were too bad. We weren't able to get the bill through. So we actually had to create the law ourselves, which is a citizen initiated law, and gather petitions across the state in order to put it on the ballot for the people of Michigan to decide. And because it was a citizen-initiated law that was enacted, it actually now requires a three-quarters majority for the legislature today to even try to overturn or change, which is good because it's protected that law for so long. It's also bad because if you want to tweak it, you need to get a three-quarters majority vote to change it. So it definitely is the only reason why it still stands today is because it is highly popular and well-loved by the citizens of Michigan. All the polling data says it is. But, again, it would have been gone if we hadn't done it in that fashion. But that requires an entirely huge ground game of volunteers getting those signatures back in the 70s, because that was before the time of having paid circulators and things like that that you see in those campaigns today.
Oh, yeah. I remember a lot of those days well from canvassing during high school and college.
Ten cents a can. I thought you were talking about paid toilets. But looking at your event schedule, this chainsaw safety and stewardship workshop, how did that work out?
There were no injuries, so that's the first thing. great thing to be able to say. But that was really that's one of our most requested trainings that we put on, and it had been a few years since we had been able to do it, so we were excited to be able to offer it finally again. That is really a part of our On the Ground program that we run. So On the Ground is actually a partnership between MUCC and the DNR's Wildlife Division, where we take, we're funded to create this program of volunteers giving back to public lands here in Michigan. And so we're charged with, you know, doing all of the work to recruit the volunteers, to set up these events across the state, and to do habitat work on our state game areas and state forest lands, and in partnership with many other facilities and groups like conservation districts. We've worked with some of the tribes. We've worked with school groups across the state. So we have this volunteer army now that has been developed over the course of time. We've had more than, thousands and thousands of volunteer hours dedicated to conservation here in our state through this program. And the chainsaw safety training is really just one of those ways that we can arm our volunteers with good information, you know, to make sure that they're doing things safely on our future projects, but also so that they can learn these tools to do work even back home or, you know, on the places where they might hunt or take advantage of. So that's why we've gotten involved in the chainsaw safety training realm. It's a little bit, doesn't sound like it would be in the scope, but I wanted to give you a little bit more of that backstory because it's really about the, you know, some of the best wildlife habitat comes at the end of a chainsaw, and that's why we do that.
Well, I'm not Chris. You know, we had a commercial forester on several years ago on one of our podcasts, and you know, he was he was very concerned with people in chainsaws and used to lay awake nights worried about it because, you know, he said a lot of people just are not prepared to handle those things, and you know, it's encouraging to see somebody is doing some kind of training.
There's
absolutely scary. It's not something you learn in school either.
It's an OJT thing. You know, I mean, the guy with two fingers, how long you've been using a chainsaw? 2 years, you know. So it's kind of an interesting thing.
It's neat though that and I think it speaks to the breadth of your offerings. To that end, Amy, you guys put out a magazine, Michigan of Out of Doors, correct?
Yeah, Michigan Out of Doors magazine is a benefit of membership. So all of our members have access to that magazine. Individual members get it in print. Our club members get it digitally, and then they can choose to upgrade that to print if they wish. But it's a quarterly magazine. And, you know, we try to do all the traditional things you would expect a hunting and fishing magazine to do with tips and tricks and things like that. But we really get into a lot more of the storytelling and also the heritage and the conservation of it. So those are some really important things to us to have in that magazine.
So you have individual and club or corporate type business memberships?
So the affiliate clubs are what I mean when I say club membership. So when a group joins MUCC, like the Oakland County Sportsmen's Club, all of their members become our members. And so they're affiliated through their local club. But you can join just as an average citizen as well, as an individual. For just $35, you can join online, you can sign up with the form in the back of our magazine. You can come to one of the many outdoor shows across the state and join through that as well. But yeah, so we do have a membership that are both.
And Amy, I guess we'd be remiss if we didn't tell our listeners, this is MUCC.org. Is that correct?
Correct. MUCC.org.
Excellent. Excellent. People rush to your keyboards. Join today.
Well, $85 and you get a magazine. I mean, what the heck?
Well, exactly. And then, you know, you can always gift a membership to somebody else and just in time for the holidays.
Yeah, and we actually also have another magazine called our Tracks magazine. And this is really targeted more for our younger conservationists, so upper elementary school, basically. But that is a subscription as well. It's 8 months out of the year, so it's during the school year, October through May, and each month is focused on a different species of Michigan. So we try to make sure that it is actually aligned with the fourth and fifth grade science curriculum so that teachers can use it in your schools. I actually sponsor my daughter's classroom in fifth grade down here, but our club sponsor the Tract magazine and some of their local communities as well. But then you can buy it and have it come to your home or send it to your grandkids as well. So it's a really great opportunity to have science education for kids too.
Okay, my grandson Brooks, I see a subscription in his holiday stocking. That's awesome. Great.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, you guys have a broad scope of things you do. It's really really amazing that you get that much done with.
It's very impressive. I mean, I am going to circle back just because we're just kind of in the, you know, last few days of the first phase of grouse season. Relative to looking ahead, do you see a point where you might advocate for the introduction of birds maybe found in a warmer zone to be introduced into this zone in anticipation of a temperature increase?
Oh, wow. I don't think that's something our membership has really contemplated at this point. Certainly, we're supportive of the pheasant release program, you know, which really is not at this the way it has been introduced kind of in modern times is not about necessarily reintroduction and repopulation of pheasants. It's actually just more about recreational opportunity and getting people out rather than trying to restore the population. But, you know, that's something that's interesting to say because, you know, on the other end, we have the reintroduction of Arctic grayling, which would actually be kind of the opposite in terms of, you know, a climate resilient species.
Oh, to be sure. I mean, that's, I think, one of my personal areas of concern relative to the brook trout and the water temperatures that they prefer versus the, you know, water temperature increases we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the short term, though, I really view a lot of things that we can do to make fish and wildlife more resilient in the short term are important. So I mentioned earlier dam removals, and, you know, MUCC hasn't taken a position on every single dam in the state of Michigan because there are some benefits derived by people on both sides of the dam. I'm sure your listeners probably have more of a perspective than we do, but we have members that enjoy the reservoirs and enjoy the streams as well. But,
100%.
You know, that when we remove a dam, though, we can reduce the water temperature by almost 8 degrees in some cases. And so, you know, sometimes that is the best, you know, use of our monetary resources if you're trying to combat that temperature warming.
Oh, 100%. We've seen that, you know, with some initiatives through TU locally with the East Branch of the Asable reconnection effort. And it's, and you know what, consumers looking at 13 different dams right now. And to your point, it's not a binary deal. There's a lot of gray there. The Tippy Dam on the Manistee would be a good example of that. There are, you know, a lot of benefits to the temperature, but, you know, maybe there's some risks relative to the lamprey coming in.
Absolutely. So it's not a one-size-fits-all, you know, conversation, and I do think we need to be careful at looking at all the aspects,
right,
you know, before making a determination. But in terms of just public funding, it is tricky to say, okay, well, consumers, you know, if they don't want to own the dam anymore, well, who's going to take ownership of it and who's going to pay to maintain it and
mm-hmm.
who's going to do all of that stuff? Because right now they want to get out of the business because some of those are at the end of their lifespan. So they're either going to have to be fixed and there's going to be a bunch of money put into them to make them, you know, go into the, you know, next century, or there's going to be a bunch of money put in to take them out. So, you know, that is a public conversation that we need to be having because it's going to be resource funding, resource intensive either way.
So help me on that one, Amy, because I guess I thought the DCOM costs were basically baked in from day from go live day, that from the day they built it, they were planning on decommissioning it and allocating funds to, not perhaps in total, but certainly to serve as a foundation for DCOM.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, but there's a lot of members of the public that want to keep those dams. And so what I guess I'm just trying to say is there's a cost to keeping them as well. So, but, you know, there's also a lot more out there than just the 13 consumers dams. So, you know, dams is a conversation that we're having across the state because the state owns some of them too. And so those are the ones that I guess would be more of a public funding, you know, removal necessary.
Oh, good stuff. Good stuff. Amy, this has been great. Richard and I are very grateful for you joining us and enlightening our listeners and exposing another conservation organization in our wonderful state.
Well, I really appreciate it. I'm proud and honored to lead such a longstanding and respected organization like Michigan United Conservation Club. I never knew I was going to be here this long to be able to lead it, you know, when I started here back 16 years ago. But I'm glad to be here. I work day in and day out. I live and breathe this, and I really do enjoy it. It's something different every day. Some days are hard, but certainly it is. It keeps me on my toes every single day.
Well, I think the organization is in very good hands going forward, and hopefully a few of our listeners that may not be involved with the organization will be so shortly after publication. So, Amy, thanks again. Great job.
Thanks, Amy. Hang
on. I appreciate it.
Good fun. Amy's a neat lady. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. We're on our irregular publication schedule, so... we may have one more before the holidays, so just kind of keep an ear out. We'll be back hitting it hard come season opener, but we will have some entertainment for you through the winter season. So with that, we wish you well. Do good things, and as always, mind your back cast.